Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to see you, everyone here in the room and everyone online. It's good to be seen by you. So we're glad that you have chosen to spend this part of your day with us. So the average life expectancy in the United States is 76.1 years old. So, I don't know if you guys heard her. She goes, ooh, I'm close. I'm very close. So some of you feel like you're on borrowed time. So what I didn't know about life expectancy is that there are several different ways that they calculate life expectancy. Who knew? You figured, but there's different formulas. And to try to explain the different formulas is more than is really in the scope of what we talk about today, and would miss the whole point. But it was fascinating to look at the different ways to arrive at almost the same number. So the average life expectancy is 76.1 years old. There was a time in history where the life expectancy was much, much greater than 76.1 years old. In the Old Testament part of the Bible, there's some stories about people and how long they lived and all of that. There's a guy named Methuselah who lived to be 969 years old. 969 years old. Methuselah's dad was a guy by the name of Enoch. And Enoch lived to be 365. Actually, Enoch lived 365 years. And then the writer of Genesis tells us that then he was no more because God took him away. Now, there's no record that Enoch actually died. And so I don't know how he affects the average life expectancy. Because in that generation, if he's still living, it just keeps going up. If you mark the day when God took him away, then that's part of the life expectancy. So there was a time when the life expectancy was much different. The years 2020 and 2021 marked the sharpest decline in life expectancy in more than 100 years. Now, though the pandemic certainly contributed to that, the studies show that there are other factors involved. There was an increase in accidental deaths in those 2 years. There was an increase in drug overdoses those 2 years. There was an increase in cardiac events those 2 years. There was an increase in chronic liver disease those 2 years. And so even though we would contribute a lot of the decline into the pandemic, there were other factors involved. So there's also a time in history where there was a sharp decline in the life expectancy of humankind. It was a time in history where the world was not functioning as God intended for it to function. And God reached a point with the history of the world at that moment where this is what he said. He said, "My spirit will not put up with humans for such a long time." So in other words, you got people living 969 years, 300, 800, you got all these people living all these years, and God says, "My spirit will not put up with them for such a long time, for they are only mortal flesh. In the future, their normal lifespan will be no more than 120 years. And so there are people that have lived longer and all that, but the normal lifespan at this point in time was 120 years. Because humankind is only mortal flesh, cannot live forever, and my spirit will not put up with humans for such a long time, would indicate that maybe God was a little bit frustrated. That maybe God was a little bit upset with humankind, and he put a cap on the frustration. Not just his frustration, but the frustration of humankind as well. Can you imagine living in the world in which we live for longer than 76.1 years on average, or 120 years as the normal lifespan? It's almost like God said, the world's broken, and I'm going to put a cap on the experience. I'm going to cap the experience because not only can I not put up with them, but I'm not going to have them have to deal with it as well. So, about 120 years pass, which is throughout this part of the biblical narrative, there's multiple times where 120 years pass. And it's fascinating that as 120 years pass, it's the normal lifespan. So about 120 years pass, and things in the world don't continue to improve. God doesn't get any less frustrated with the condition of the world and the behavior of humankind. In fact, the biblical narrative tells us, says, the Lord observed the extent of human wickedness on the earth and saw that everything they thought or imagined was consistently and totally evil. So, the Lord was sorry He had ever made them and put them on the earth. It broke His heart. So at this point in history, the behavior of humankind literally broke the heart of God, to the point that God was sorry He ever made humankind and put them on the earth. Which is fascinating when you consider the creation account, that God created the heavens and the earth, God created everything, and as He went through the creation process, He declared everything good. But now, because the world was consistently and totally evil, there was nothing good in the world God had created and declared good. When He created humankind, He declared it to be very good. And now, it says everything they thought, everything humankind, the very humankind that God had created and put into creation and declared very good, everything they thought was consistently and totally evil, to the point that it broke God's heart, and He was sorry that He ever made them and put them on the earth. Can you imagine? Can you imagine a world that was so totally evil and corrupt that it broke the heart of God, to the point that He was sorry He ever made them and put them on the earth? I think this is one of the things that's difficult for us to wrap our mind. And the word, the Hebrew word that's used, that's translated extent, that the Lord observed the extent of the wickedness, the Hebrew word there is that the level of wickedness, the extent that it continued to increase over and over and over. So it wasn't like just a level. It continued to get worse and worse and worse. I think sometimes this is hard for us to imagine, because there are times where I think some of us look at the condition of our world and wonder, how can it get any worse than this? Right? I mean, we go around and you see just some of the behavior that we would conclude is totally and consistently evil. And you look around and you go, how can it get any worse than this? And then the next story in the news is about the Good Samaritan who stepped in and rescued someone. The Good Samaritan who stepped in and helped someone in need. And in those moments when we hear those stories, we're like, wow, there is good in our world. There are pockets of good. There still are good people in our world. In the midst of all the bad that we experience, there's still pockets of good in our world, and there's still good people in our world. So can you imagine how bad it must have been in the days of this part of the biblical narrative? Everything they thought, everything everyone thought was consistently and totally evil. There was nothing good left. And it broke the heart of God to the point that He was sorry He ever made them and regretted putting them on the earth. And so in the midst of that, God makes a decision. Imagine the moment in history where God throws up His hands and says, I've had enough. I can't put up with them much longer. I'm going to cap it at 120 years. And then 120 years later, things haven't gotten better. They've gotten worse. And God goes, well, 120 years later, they still haven't learned their lesson. They still haven't changed. They've only gotten worse. And God says, I'm so brokenhearted. I'm sorry I ever did this. And then here's what he says. He says, I will wipe this human race I have created. I mean, think about how brokenhearted God must be when he says this word. I will wipe this human race I have created. And if you were with us a couple of weeks ago, remember, and if you weren't with us a couple of weeks ago, I'll catch up. But this was the very creation that God formed from the dust, formed with his hands, personally, deeply involved in the creation, intimately involved in the creation of humankind, and breathed the breath of life into them. And now it's gotten so bad that God says, I will wipe this human race that I have created from the face of the earth. Yes, and I will destroy every living thing, all the people, the large animals, the small animals, that scurry along the ground, and even the birds of the sky. I am sorry I ever made them. Can you imagine what this must have been like for God? Everything I create, it's all bad now. And I'm just going to destroy it. There's a fascinating wordplay that goes on in this part of the biblical narrative. So earlier it says that it was totally corrupt. And here it says that I'll destroy everything. That's the same word. And it's translated a little differently in context. But when you put them together in context, the translation actually renders itself that the world has destroyed itself, so it's going to be destroyed. The world has destroyed itself, so it's going to be destroyed. So brokenhearted, sorry he ever made them, decides to destroy everything. But even in this moment, even in this part of history, because of God's great love, because of his great mercy, and because of his great grace, he also decides to initiate a grand do-over. And it says, but Noah found favor with the Lord. Sometimes, don't you just love that word, but? I mean, sometimes not so much. I mean, you know, my kids will tell you that there's a lot of times where our conversations all of a sudden be, okay, here comes the but. Here it comes. Well, I was going to, but. Well, I was going to, but I didn't. Well, I know you asked me to do that, but I chose to do something else. You know, so, sometimes not a lot of good comes after the but. However, in this case, Noah enters the pages of history after the corrupt destruction announcement, wiping everything from the face of the earth, but Noah found favor with the Lord. This is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, the only blameless person living on the earth at that time, and he walked in close fellowship with God. Everything was totally corrupt. Everything was totally wicked and evil and all of that. But there's this guy by the name of Noah. And here's the story of Noah. Noah found favor with God because he was the only blameless person that walked the face of the earth. Now, when it says blameless, it doesn't mean that Noah was perfect. It doesn't mean that Noah always got it right. And it doesn't mean that Noah was necessarily any better or worse than anybody else in comparison. It meant there was something different about Noah than there was about everybody else. He found favor with God because he was righteous. And he was blameless. In other words, in a world that was totally morally wicked and evil, Noah tried to do the right thing. Because what set Noah apart was, it says, and he walked in close fellowship with God. Everything else but Noah. And so God decided to initiate a grand do-over because of one. Because there was one righteous man. Because there was one who was blameless. Because there was one who walked in close fellowship with God. God decided to initiate a grand do-over in the very creation he said he would destroy. And here's the thing. God could have destroyed everything, including Noah, including his family, and he could have started over. God could have destroyed everything and not started over. God could have just destroyed it and that was that. But here's a fascinating thing. God chose to initiate a grand do-over with the very creation and the very humankind that he was sorry he ever made. I don't know about you, but if that isn't grace, if that is a mercy. So, as part of this grand do-over, God comes up with this great plan. He goes to Noah and say, Noah, I'm going to destroy everything. And this time God says, it's going to be by a flood. And so I want you to build a boat. And here's what this boat's going to look like. And when it starts to rain, I want you and your family to get on the boat. And I'll close the door for you. But when you get on the boat, and in the meantime, I want you to gather two of every kind of animal, and seven clean, seven unclean, enough to food. I want you to gather all this stuff. I want you to take it all in the boat with you. Now, it's going to stink for a while. But the stink that you'll deal with is nothing compared to the stink I've dealt with in the time frame of humankind. So, God says, I want you to build this boat. And so Noah starts building a boat. Any guess how long it takes Noah to build this boat? 120 years. Most scholars believe it takes 120 years for Noah to build the boat, which is the normal lifespan, right? So God has announced, I'm going to destroy everything. Noah, build a boat. And in that 120 years, maybe humankind will change. Maybe I won't have to destroy everything. I'm obviously reading in to God's thoughts, which who knows how close I would get to that. But God, I mean, you got to wonder if God didn't think, maybe they'll change. If I give them a whole human lifespan, maybe they'll change. So Noah, build the boat. Okay, here's the thing. I can't imagine the people didn't notice Noah building the boat. And I can't imagine that when people came by and mocked and ridiculed for Noah building the boat, Noah didn't tell them why. I have to believe that Noah looked at him and said, I'm building this boat because God told me to, because God says he's fed up with you people and he's going to destroy everything. And I have to wonder if maybe Noah didn't believe in his heart. Hey, if you guys get your act together, maybe God will spare you. Maybe God will change course here. And not have to destroy it if you guys get your act together. Again, I'm reading into the story and I understand that. So, but that's how God chose to initiate this grand do-over in the world that was so broken that he was sorry he ever made him. And then there's this line. This line says, when everything was ready. When everything was ready. So when the 120 years had passed and humankind hadn't changed and they'd mocked and ridiculed and made fun of Noah, and Noah got the boat together and all the animals had gathered around and everything, so God said to Noah, go into the boat with all your family. For among all the people of the earth, I can see that you alone are righteous. That you alone are righteous. You know, here's the thing. No matter what our world is like, no matter what decisions everybody else makes, no matter how corrupt and evil and wicked and all of that our world becomes, each and every one of us has the opportunity to be like Noah, to be the one in whom God finds favor, to be the one who is righteous, to be the one who is blameless, to be the one who walks in close fellowship with God, to be the one that says, I can see that you alone are righteous. And guess what? If you do that, and I do that, and the people around us do that, it's not you alone. I can see that you together are righteous. And if God can initiate a grand do-over with one, I have to believe that God can initiate a grand do-over with more than one. When everything was ready, God said, go, get in the boat. And then it started to rain. And then it tells that the rain fell. The rain continued to fall for 40 days and 40 nights. For 40 days, the floodwaters grew deeper. Now, do the math real quick. 40 days, 40 nights, 40 days. What do you get to? 120. And it's not 120, it's 120 sections, but it's still 120. The floodwaters grew deeper, covering the ground and lifting the boat high above the earth. For 40 days it rained. And it says torrents of rain fell from the sky. And in Genesis, it also says that not only did the torrents of rain fall from the sky, but waters arose from underneath. The amount of water here is like no amount of water that had ever been experienced in history of creation before. It's described as a total deluge of water. Water from above and water from below. And it just consumed everything in its path. But notice, covering the ground and excuse me, lifting the boat high above the earth. So you got rain coming down, water coming up, a deluge of water, and everything in its path is being destroyed. All the people who had ridiculed and mocked Noah were caught up in the flood. All of the animals, everything, every living thing, excuse me, every living creature is being destroyed. And what's happening with Noah and his family? They're in the boat and they're being lifted above the earth. There is in the story a picture of redemption, a picture of grace, a picture of the grand do-over that God has initiated in the midst of a world totally corrupt and wicked and evil. There's one. He and his family are being lifted above the corruption, above the destruction, above the judgment, and they are being rescued and redeemed so that the world can be restored through them. God could have done it 120 different ways. God chose to do it this way. So, the floodwaters gradually receded from the earth. After 150 days, exactly 5 months from the time the flood began, the boat came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. The Hebrew word that's used for rest there is, it communicates a gentle, soft coming to rest. You know, and I have to think at this particular moment that Noah could use some type of rest. You know, 120 years and nothing had changed and the world continued to get more and more corrupt. And I have to wonder if Noah didn't get tired. I mean, you know what it's like when you're the only one standing up for someone and you continue to stand up for them and everybody else is against them and you feel like the whole world stacked against you, but you're the one. And you just kind of get tired. You know, Noah was the only righteous one on the face of the earth, and I have to wonder if he got tired. And as he built the boat and people mocked him and ridiculed him and his back hurt and he got tired, I wonder if he just said, And then the rain started, and the rain started for 40 days, and he wondered if it was ever going to stop raining. And then the floodwaters continued to increase for 40 days, and he wondered, is it ever going to recede? And then for the next 5 months, they're in the boat. Under these elephants, ever going to stop pooping? And am I ever going to have to stop cleaning it up? And is it ever going to smell any better? And whatever else Noah dealt with in the boat, I think when that boat came to rest and Noah knew that the floodwaters were receding and the boat no longer floated, but now it had come to rest, I think there was this experience of grace for Noah. I think there was this desire to just exhale. And so Noah sends out a raven, and the raven comes back because there's no place for it to land yet because the waters hadn't receded far enough. And then Noah sends out a dove, and the dove comes back. And then 7 days later, Noah sends out another dove, and it comes back with an olive branch, which Noah says, hey, it must mean things are starting to get low enough. And then he sends out another dove, and the dove doesn't come back because it has found a place to land. And I think all of that is the rest that Noah was experiencing. And I think it's just fascinating what God provided for Noah. And so God tells Noah that it's time to disembark. Disembark. When you guys get that on the way home, text somebody and tell them. Tells them it's time to get off the boat. And Noah and his family get off the boat. And the world in which they enter is radically different from the world in which they got on the boat. Everything had been destroyed. Everything looked different. Everything felt different. Everything was different. And then it says, then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and there he sacrificed as burnt offerings the animals and the birds that had been approved for that purpose. The first thing that Noah does when he gets off the boat is he turns his attention to God. I don't know about you, but I think I'd have built a house for me and my family. It'd have been easy for Noah to say, okay, now that we've got this, we've got to do this, we've got to do this, we've got to, you know, got to build us a place to live. But no, he builds an altar to God and he sacrifices to God because of the grand do-over, because of the redemption, because of the grace, because of the rest. Noah builds an altar to God. And what he sacrifices to God is pleasing to God. It says, and the Lord was pleased with the amount or with the aroma of the sacrifice and said to himself, I will never again curse the ground because of the human race. Even though everything they think or imagine is bent toward evil from childhood, and I will never again destroy all living things. The grand do-over has been initiated. And then he goes on. Says, then God blessed Noah and his sons and told them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. So he blesses Noah and his family and tells them to be fruitful and multiply, which is the same command he gave to humankind at creation. to this grand do-over. We're going to do it again. And maybe this time it'll be different. Multiply and fill the earth. And again, God could have done this any number of ways, but he chose to do it through Noah and his family. He chose to do it through the creation that he had already created. It's just fascinating, God's grace. And then he goes on and he says, I hereby confirm my covenant with you and your descendants. Yes, I am confirming my covenant with you. A covenant. This is the first use. No, I'm sorry. It's not the first use. This is one of over 200 uses of the word covenant in the Old Testament part of the biblical narrative. In the ancient Near East, a covenant was made between two people, and it was considered to be morally and legally binding. The key part of the covenant was what was required of each person for the covenant to be kept. And in this covenant, God does not put any requirement on Noah. God does not put any requirement on humankind for the covenant to be kept. God says, I will keep my covenant. I will confirm my covenant. And I am confirming my covenant. And then in the ancient Near East, a covenant was often confirmed with a sign. And God says, I am giving you a sign of my covenant with you and all living creatures. Not just humankind, all living creatures. For all generations to come, not just for Noah, not just for his sons, not just for his grandkids and all that, for all generations. The covenant God makes here is for all people in all generations. No matter what the normal lifespan is, God's covenant here is made for all generations. I have placed my rainbow in the clouds. It is the sign of my covenant with you and with all the earth. In simplest forms, a rainbow appears visually when the sun hits drops of rain. And so a rainbow, and anyway, it's an unfiltered thought that I've been processing, and so don't, they say rarely ever communicate unprocessed and unfiltered thoughts. So, what the heck? When I read this again this morning, all of a sudden it hit me that it's like the rainbow's always there. I have placed my rainbow in the clouds. It's always there. We just don't always see it. As I thought, that was interesting that it's always there. The sign of God's covenant is always there, whether we see it or not. The sign of the covenant is always there. So the rainbow requires the rain, which is what God used to destroy everything. But it also requires the sun, which God used to dry out everything and to begin the process of restoration. The rainbow requires both. It requires, and the rainbow communicates this hope that things can be different. That we experience the rain, but we also experience the sun. And it's a sign of the covenant that we remember God's promise when we see the rainbow. And then God says, when I send clouds over the earth, the rainbow will appear in the clouds. Again, it's always there, but when the rain comes, it will appear in the clouds. And it says, and I, so again, this is God, and I will remember my covenant with you and with all living creatures. Now, this isn't to say that God forgets, and it isn't to say that God needs a reminder like we remember, but it's almost like it's a continually bringing God back to his love and grace and compassion for humankind. And that's just, it's something that's still difficult for me to wrap my mind around, that God continues to come back to his love and grace and mercy and compassion. So, and with all living creatures, never again Will the floodwaters destroy all life? When I see the rainbow in the clouds, I will remember the eternal covenant between God and every living creature on earth. The covenant made here is an eternal covenant, a perpetual covenant for all time, that never again will the floodwaters destroy the earth. And when God sees the rainbow, when the rainbow appears, God will remember the covenant between humankind. The Hebrew word that's used for rainbow is the same word that's used for a bow, as in hunting and military and war. And if you'll notice, the shape of a rainbow is the shape of an archery bow. But also, if you'll notice, the apex of the bow is pointing away from humankind and away from creation. A covenant was made as a treaty, as a form of peace after war. And after the destruction of humankind and all living things, God implements, it's almost, one of the things I read is it's almost like God's taking the bow and hanging it up on the clouds and laying it to rest. As that is his symbol, that is his covenant of the rest and the peace that God desires between him and humankind. So when God initiated the grand do-over, everything in humankind, it was totally and consistently evil. There was nothing good. But there was one. A guy by the name of Noah. When it started to rain, there was one. When the terms of the covenant are on God, not on us. One of the first things that Noah does is screw it up. The terms of the covenant were not on Noah's ability to get it right all the time. The terms of the covenant are not on our ability to get it right all the time. The terms of the covenant are on God's love, grace, mercy, and compassion on humankind. And I don't know about you, but that's probably a good thing. It's probably a good thing that the terms of the covenant are not contingent on me getting it right every time. And so when we see the rainbow, we see a reminder, a sign of God's eternal covenant. But I also think we see a reminder of God's frustration, his disappointment, and his immense capacity to make things right in a world that has gone horribly wrong. And so I wonder sometimes how far will we push God? You know, I mean, we like sometimes to push to the line. We like to sometimes approach things with, how much can I get away with before I get in trouble? How much can I get by with before the hammer drops? And so I wonder, how far do we have to push God before we will really allow ourselves to experience God's love, grace, mercy, and compassion? And then I wonder, why do we have to push God that far? The rainbow's always there. We just don't always see it. God's love, grace, compassion, and mercy is always there. Sometimes we just don't always see it. And sometimes we try to take advantage of it. So, let me pray for us this morning. And then we'll roll the preview for part two. Not even part two. We're like start to finish. I don't even know what part we're in. Next week will be like the fourth part, but they're all like individual things. So there's no parts, but bunch of parts, and parts is parts, and I don't know. So we'll roll the preview video for next week, and then we'll be dismissed. So, dear God, thank you for today. Thank you for loving us enough to initiate a grand do-over. Not just for humankind, not just for creation, not just for Noah's day, but for me. Thank you for loving me enough at a time when the world was thoroughly corrupt and evil to initiate a grand do-over and to not make the terms of that do-over contingent on my ability to get it right. God, help each and every one of us to not push you to the edge, but to live in a way like Noah, where you would say, there's one who's blameless, one who's righteous. I pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.